All right, so today we're diving into a case, Gabriel v. Cazier. And it's really fascinating. It's like one of those classic neighborhood disputes that you hear about, where things get a little heated.
Oh, yeah.
But this one like really spirals into this whole legal battle over property law and especially, restrictive covenants, those rules that kind of govern so many communities.
Right, great.
And the thing that's so interesting about this case is how like a simple rule, like a ban on business activities, ended up causing this whole fight over swim lessons in a backyard pool and what business even means.
Totally. Yeah, this case is like a textbook example of how you can have these words in a legal document that seem totally straightforward, but then when you apply them to real life, it gets super messy.
Yeah, exactly.
So think of this deep dive as like a behind-the-scenes look at how courts try to make sense of these agreements. We're going to break down the legal stuff in a way that hopefully makes sense without getting too jargony. And trust me, there are some real head-scratching moments in this case.
Oh,
That
yeah.
will really make you think about like what common words actually mean in a legal
Oh,
context.
absolutely. We're talking about a case where a portable toilet was considered a violation of the rules, but running a whole summer swim school wasn't.
It's wild, right?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. And like, to make it even more interesting, the person who actually wrote the original covenant had to come in and testify and explain what they meant. So really, in this deep dive, we want to figure out how courts deal with like unclear language in these property agreements and what they really focus on when they decide if a homeowner is breaking the rules.
So to set the stage a little bit, imagine like your typical suburb, nice houses, well-maintained lawns, maybe one of those neighborhood newsletters that gets delivered. And a lot of these places have what are called restrictive covenants, which are basically a set of rules, designed to keep the neighborhood looking a certain way and to kind of protect property values. Yeah, they try to keep some consistency across the neighborhood.
And in this particular subdivision, one of those rules was no business activities.
Okay, sounds pretty simple, right?
Yeah, on the surface, it seems pretty straightforward. But then you have the Kazier family, and their kids start offering these swim lessons in their backyard pool during the summer. And we're talking about them making around $10,000 each summer.
Wow, that's actually, it's nothing for a seasonal thing.
No, especially for something run by kids, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But along with that, money came more traffic, parents driving their kids to and from the lessons.
Sure, yeah, makes sense.
Now, here's something really interesting, and this is actually in the court documents. At least two other families in the same subdivision were doing the exact same thing, giving swim lessons, and it doesn't seem like anyone really cared.
So it was kind of like an accepted thing.
Yeah, it seems that way. No complaints, no lawsuits,
Wow.
until the Gabriels, who lived across the street from the Kaziers, decided to take action.
Oh, so they were the ones who really had an issue with it.
Yeah, they filed a lawsuit wanting the court to order the Kaziers to stop the swim lessons. They argued it was a clear violation of that no business activities rule.
So you have this situation where the same thing is happening in other places without any problems, and then boom, lawsuit. So what did the trial court think about all this? What was their take on the swim lessons and the whole legal argument?
Well, the trial court's first decision was kind of surprising. They actually said that the swim lessons did not count as a business under that specific wording of the rule.
Oh, so the Kaziers were in the clear then, at least on that part.
Yeah, for the moment. But you mentioned earlier that something else was considered a violation. And this is where it gets a little strange. The court did find that a portable toilet the Kaziers had on their property for the swim lessons, that was a violation.
Wait, so they're okay with the whole swim school operation, but the portable toilet is where they draw the line. That seems kind of backwards. How did the court explain that?
Well, they really focused on what they thought was the intended purpose of the whole covenant. They looked beyond just the fact that money was changing hands and considered other things too,
Like what kinds of things?
like the noise level, the increased traffic, and maybe the most important thing, the fact that the swim lessons were temporary and seasonal.
Okay, so because it wasn't a year-round thing, it wasn't as disruptive.
But the portable toilet, they saw that as more permanent and potentially more of a problem.
So it's all about how the court interprets the impact of the activity, not just whether money is involved. Okay, let's talk more about this whole definition of business, because that seems to be at the core of this case. Why did the court decide that charging for swim lessons didn't make it a business activity in this specific case?
So the main issue here is that the covenant itself didn't actually define what business meant.
Oh, so it was just kind of left open-ended.
Right. And the court acknowledged that business is a super broad term. Legally speaking, it could mean almost anything, you know, from a kid selling lemonade to a huge company.
Right, right. Like a whole spectrum.
Exactly. And because the covenant didn't say specifically what kinds of activities counted as business activities, mm-hmm. the court said it was unclear how it applied to these swim lessons.
So how did they figure out what the people who wrote the rules originally intended if the language was so vague?
This is where it gets really interesting for you, legally speaking.
Okay.
They actually brought in the person who wrote the original covenants like years and years ago.
Wow.
To testify in court.
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah. And this person said under oath that the no business activities rule was meant to stop things like permanent businesses, mm-hmm. like auto repair shops running out of garages or kennels with dogs barking, you know, things that would change the feel of the neighborhood.
Right. Like actually commercial operations.
Exactly. And they specifically said it wasn't intended to stop temporary things like kids giving swim lessons.
Okay, so the court used that original intention to figure out how to apply the rule in this case.
Right. It's like they were trying to get inside the minds of the people who wrote the rules.
Yeah, to understand the spirit of law, not just the exact words.
Exactly. And this idea connects to a bigger legal principle that's important to know.
Okay, what's that?
When a restrictive covenant is unclear, courts usually interpret it in a way that favors the homeowner's right to use their land.
So they give the homeowner the benefit of the doubt?
Yeah, they don't want to restrict what people can do with their property unless the rules are super clear.
Makes sense.
Now, you mentioned earlier that other families in the neighborhood were also giving swim lessons without any complaints.
Right, right. Like it was a common thing.
Yeah, and the court thought that was really important too.
Why is that?
Well, it suggested that the covenant wasn't really meant to ban this kind of activity.
Yeah, like if everyone was doing it and no one cared, it implied some kind of unspoken agreement.
Exactly. It's almost like the community's own actions were showing how they understood the rule.
Right. It's like their behavior was more important than the actual words on paper.
Precisely.
So the Gabriels didn't win on that business argument, but they also tried to say that the swim lessons were a nuisance
right.
because of the noise and the traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Did that work out for them?
No. The Idaho Supreme Court, which is the court that had the final say on the case,
mm-hmm.
they rejected that nuisance claim, too.
Okay.
They said that the amount of noise and traffic from the swim lessons wasn't unreasonable, and it didn't really interfere with the Gabriels' enjoyment of their own property.
So just being annoyed by some extra cars and splashing isn't enough to be a legal nuisance?
Right. There's a pretty high bar for what counts as a nuisance legally.
What does it take to actually prove a nuisance, then?
The interference has to be significant, mm-hmm. and it can't be justified. You know, it has to be bad enough that it really prevents someone from using and enjoying their property.
Okay, so like a little bit of noise and inconvenience isn't going to cut it.
Exactly.
Now, we should mention there was a separate opinion in this case from Justice Schroeder.
Yes, that's right.
Can you explain what that was all about?
Sure. So Justice Schroeder agreed with the overall outcome of the case, but he had a different reason for why he thought the Kazzeers should win.
Okay, what was his reasoning?
He argued that the no business activities rule had basically been abandoned.
Abandoned. What does that even mean in this context?
Well, his argument was that because similar swim lesson activities had been happening openly in the neighborhood for years, from 1988 to 1995, and nobody had really tried to enforce the rule or complained much, the covenant had essentially become unenforceable, at least when it came to that specific activity.
So it's like the neighborhood had collectively decided to ignore that part of the rule.
That's the general idea behind this legal concept of abandonment.
Interesting.
Justice Schroeder thought that even if the rule could have originally included swim lessons, the fact that the community hadn't enforced it for so long meant it couldn't be used against the Kazzeers.
So if enough people break a rule and no one does anything about it for long enough, the rule basically loses its power.
Yeah, that's kind of the logic behind it.
Wow.
It's important to note, though, that the majority of the court didn't actually agree with this argument.
Okay.
They focus more on that original intent idea. But Justice Schroeder's opinion is still really interesting because it introduces this whole other legal argument that could be relevant in other cases where rules haven't been enforced.
Right, right. So zooming out a bit, what are the big takeaways here for our listeners? What should they be thinking about if they encounter something similar with restrictive covenants?
I think we can boil it down to three main questions to ask.
Okay.
First, is the rule that's being broken actually unclear or open to different interpretations?
Right.
Second, what evidence is there about what the people who wrote the rules originally intended?
Mm-hmm.
And third, does the activity actually cause a serious and unreasonable problem for the neighbors?
Okay, so those are the key things to consider.
Yeah, and if you're a legal professional, this case really emphasizes how important it is to write those covenants with really clear language from the start.
Right, so you avoid these kinds of messy situations.
Exactly, and it also shows how important it can be to understand the history behind these agreements. Mm. You might need to look at old documents or even talk to the people who wrote them.
Like they did in this case.
Exactly.
So the big lesson here seems to be that if the language of a rule isn't crystal clear, courts are more likely to let homeowners do what they want with their property.
Right. The basic assumption is that property owners have the right to use their land, and any restrictions on that right have to be stated very clearly.
Gabriel V. Cazier, it's not just a silly fight between neighbors. It actually tells us a lot about how the legal system works.
Yeah.
And how courts try to balance the rights of homeowners with the rules of a community.
Absolutely. It shows that even simple rules can become super complicated in real life.
Hmm.
And the intentions behind those rules are really important.
So for our listeners out there, think about this. How might changing norms and activities in a neighborhood affect how legal agreements are interpreted over time?
That's a great point.
Like imagine someone running a tutoring business from their home or selling drafts online. Could those be considered businesses under different circumstances?
It really makes you think about how property law and community expectations are constantly changing.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
It was a pleasure.
We'll catch you next time.
See you then.